Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Aaron Newcomb joins me. We're going to talk to the guys that make OpenROV, a little underwater robot that has a neat little camera and a nice long tether, and you can go look at things underwater. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Aaron Newcomb, episode 226, recorded September 13th, 2012. OpenROV. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneEngine.com, bringing you each week, or as often as I can get to it, the movers, the shakers, the big projects, little projects, projects you might not have ever heard of, projects that maybe you work with every day. And this week is no exception. I also have a co-host this week, which also is a non-exception. Hey, Aaron, welcome back to the show. Aaron Newcomb.
Hey, Randall. Good to be here.
Cool. Hey, wow, that background's a little different. Are you somewhere unusual today?
Back in the brick house, and we are in the what we call the living room set here. Very cozy, very casual, and we actually have our ghosts in house. We have our guests in house today, so we thought we'd just sit down and keep it casual and talk about today's project.
Very good, very good. Well, it's a really good special show for today. We have, in fact, in-house, as you said, Brand Sorum and Eric Stackpole, who are representing the OpenROV project, which is a way to bring... Oh, they're waving if you're watching the video. We'll get to you in a second, guys. But OpenROV, from what I can see over on the website here, which is actually pretty cool, they've got some nice videos and stuff, is little robots that go underwater. It's so cool. They do remote control. I guess they've got some sort of control system for it. We'll have to ask them how that all works. And there's this long tether behind it. I think that's if the batteries wear out, they can just tug it back to the ship, so it makes it easy to bring it on back. And I know that's not what it's for, but we'll see anyway. It looks like it's going to be pretty fun. What have you seen on it so far, Aaron?
Well, I'm just excited because it's open hardware, open source. Actually met these guys down at Maker Faire, the Bay Area Maker Faire, and they had this little robot in a tub, and people were controlling it. It was going up and down. All the kids were screaming. And I thought, hey, that's pretty cool. I said, is by any chance, it's OpenROV, is by any chance any of this open source as well? And they said, yeah, it's open source and open hardware. And I said, well, we got to get you on the show. So...
Let's go ahead and let the guys talk about it then. Eric Stackpole, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. This is a really cool place you've got here.
Yeah, it is pretty fancy. Lots of good technology, lots of good fun stuff. Let's also welcome Brand Sorum to the show. Welcome, Brand.
Hello. It's great to be here.
Fast. Okay. A man of few words. That's great. That's great. Yep. Eric, let's start with you. How did the project come about, and what is it? I did a kind of a mediocre description of it. It's a robot that goes underwater. That's all I need to say about it. So tell us. I usually say the 30,000-foot view, but I think that's just wrong end for this.
Yeah. Actually, you did a pretty good introduction. OpenROV is an open source, open hardware, remotely operated vehicle. That's what OpenROV stands for. And basically, it's a robotic submarine that's about the size of a shoebox. I can show it to you later. And it's got a camera on board. And the camera sends a live video stream up to the surface. And you can look at your computer screen and see what it's seeing and drive it around just like playing a video game, except for it's a real life. Instead of flipping bits, you could be flipping rocks. The idea is that, there's so much stuff that we've never explored. The ocean is this vast, unknown abyss. And not just the ocean, but lakes and ponds and things like that, too. So if we can make this thing that people can afford and can drive around, they can explore these foreign worlds, they can see things that have never been seen before, and hopefully eventually we can even put it online so you could log on and drive an ROV somewhere and explore, unknown places.
That would be awesome. Very cool. Very cool. These things are – so you only have like one design so far, right? It's all built the same way?
Yeah. So we've been using this place called Tech Shop, which is in the Bay Area, and now it's starting to spring up in other places around the country, which is kind of this machine shop that you can get access to, kind of like a gym membership. You pay a monthly fee, and you can build things. And so we started screwing around with a laser cutter and cutting these pieces of acrylic. And the idea was to kind of come up with a way of putting these parts together that's repeatable. So anyone else who has access to a laser cutter can download these files and print them, And we kind of have this one standardized design that we're starting out with. And that we're kind of thinking of like how Arduino works, where, yeah, there's a lot of microcontrollers out there. And in fact, there are microcontrollers that are more powerful and have other capabilities and even that are cheaper. But because everyone started using the Arduino, now you can build on each other's ideas. And so if we have this one ROV design and everyone's kind of making modifications to that, I think the potential for collaboration is a lot better than if everyone were kind of making a bunch of different versions that aren't compatible with each other.
And how did you get started with this? Is this something you've always had a fascination for, these robots and stuff, or underwater and stuff? Or was this a natural intersection then of your passion?
So, I mean, I'm personally really passionate about telerobotic exploration. The idea of being able to control something and explore a place that's far away from where you are. So at first I thought I really wanted to get into particularly lunar telerobotic exploration. You know, put a rover on the moon and drive it around with a joystick. That kind of led me to doing space exploration stuff. I started trying to build some satellites. I worked at NASA Ames for a little while building these. And then I realized that space is really hard to do. I mean, you can build cool technology, but you need a rocket to get there. And that often requires, if not a government, then at least a lot of money and a lot of bureaucracy. But the ocean is just as mysterious. In fact, I think it has more interesting stuff that you can find right away. You know, there's life that we know already exists there. And you don't need anything. I mean, maybe a boat if you really want to go out there, but a shore or a dock, you know, it's just right there. It's accessible and it's cool and it's unexplored. So that kind of got me into it. I guess the kind of inciting incident, I remember I was just starting out in graduate school and I went to use the bathroom. It was one of those, you know, tiled bathrooms, you know, public bathrooms that has a lot of echo. And my shoe squeaked against the floor and it kind of made that, you know, that sound like in a basketball court when you're walking and it kind of squeaks. And that echoed off the walls and it sounded kind of like that, you know, sonar ping of the old submarines. And I just remember, like, for some reason going through my head, I just pictured an ROV descending down through the dark and, you know, the water getting darker and darker with the lights shining through. And that was cool, right? I mean, that would be really fun. So, I don't know. That was kind of what got me excited about it.
Cool. Very cool, very cool. And Bran, what's your relationship with the project?
So I've been friends with Eric Stackpole since high school. We've known each other for many, many years now. And so he calls me one day and says, hey, I have this really cool project I'm working on, you know, OpenROV. And I really want to make it digital. You know, it's not as fun to kind of control it with, you know, just an analog, you know, joystick. I want to put a computer on board. And I think maybe you can help me because, you know, I do some software programming. So so 7-8 months ago, you know, he called me and I said, sure, that sounds great. So we got together and started brainstorming and, you know, taking down ideas of what it might do, like tracking and things like that. So I sat down and started programming and kind of came up with this little way of controlling the ROV from basically a little web server that's on board a little computer, which I have with me. It's called a BeagleBone. So I don't know if you see it right there. But so basically this, you know, hosts a Ubuntu Linux. And so we are using Node.js as the web server. And so I wrote a little program for that. And now you can control the ROV without having to have any software on your computer. You just need a modern web browser. So that's pretty cool.
So is that like a precursor to a Raspberry Pi? Similar to Raspberry Pi?
Yeah, so that's interesting to bring that up because we wanted something that was inexpensive and small. And
here's my Raspberry Pi.
Oh, yeah,
oh,
great.
Oh, cool.
So Raspberry
similar
Pi,
tin, right?
To yeah. So all the excitement about the Raspberry Pi was happening like right when we started, you know, doing this. We're like, oh, it would be cool if we can get one of those. But, you know, they were so hard to get, and they were, like, just starting to sell them. So we ended up looking around and found this BeagleBone, and we're pretty happy with the choice.
And you call it a BeagleBone, not a BeagleBoard?
BeagleBone. It's actually a BeagleBone. It's made by TI also, but it's just, like, a smaller version.
Okay, smaller version. But similar, same people that make BeagleBoard?
Yeah.
Okay, because I've heard of BeagleBoard, so cool.
We were really excited about the Raspberry Pi, and we still are. But at the time we were developing this, it wasn't even out yet. No one had gotten them. And it's one of the things that's really neat, I think, about OpenROV is, I mean, you know, people talk about using new technology. When we were developing OpenROV, a lot of the parts that are now on OpenROV didn't exist yet. You know, we were anticipating computers getting smaller and more affordable. The Raspberry Pi wasn't around yet. The BeagleBone had basically just come out.
Mm-hmm.
So, Yeah, I mean, it was neat. Like, something comes out, and we're like, oh, we can use that. Let's get the first version.
Right. Well, that's really what open hardware is all about, right? I mean, you can't do that kind of stuff with closed hardware, right? I mean, with closed hardware, and maybe you can talk about if you looked into this or not, because I know that since I work on enterprise hardware for a very large company, I know that, you know, we have deals with suppliers and things, and you have to plan these deals for, like, you know, years in advance, like, how is the supply chain going to work and all this stuff, and then you get these things, and it's like, you know, if something else comes out in the meantime, really can't take advantage of it because you've already signed these deals with other companies. So, I mean, talk about that. Was that part of why this is open ROV instead of closed ROV?
Yeah, I mean, so there are a lot of reasons that it's open. I mean, the biggest, most broad one is just, I think that's better for the world, mm-hmm. right? But you know, everyone's familiar with open source, and I think open hardware is kind of a lesser known thing, but I think it has much greater potential. This could be huge. And some of the aspects I see about that are, like, for open source software, I guess it's helpful because a lot of people can, you know, contribute to the programming. They can spend their time programming. That's the same with open hardware, but also with open hardware, a lot of the problems with developing that kind of stuff are cost, right? Mm-hmm. You have to, if you want to build a bunch of prototypes, you have to buy all the parts for all those prototypes, and you have to make mistakes and then buy the new parts. If I release OpenROV as an open hardware project, then suddenly I can come up with a design and 20 other people will build it, you know, 20 times the cost, and each of them will probably have an idea of how they think they can make it a little bit better. So they try a new camera or a new computer. Mm-hmm. So you have this rapid kind of iteration. It's not even iteration, it's happening in parallel,
right,
of different approaches where the survival of the fittest kind of applies. And then additionally, you have different testing environments. You have someone who lives way up in the north and they're testing it in a very cold environment, or you have someone that lives in a very near a very salty lake, and they can test it in that environment. You have people who are at different skill levels. So you have an amateur trying to build it and seeing what problems they have. You have someone who's a really good machinist who's coming up with clever ways to put it together. So the potential there is huge, really huge. Just as far as being open in general, there's a really cool aspect of it, which is something I've experienced recently. We can have some sort of a technical issue that we're trying to figure out, and, you know, maybe I can't get any sleep because it's going through my mind. It's keeping me up. How are we going to solve this? You know, as a ditch effort, as I'm dozing off, I'll put something on my phone. I'll just send a message to OpenROV onto the forums and say, hey, we're having this trouble. By the time I wake up, that question has already gone across Europe, and three or four experts who are interested in this subject have already answered what they think might be a solution. And within 24 hours, it's gone across the United States. And so in less than a day, I can have five or six really good solutions to a problem. And if this was a closed project, that just wouldn't happen. I could hire someone and they'd get back to me in a few weeks.
Right, right. So being able to tap the it's kind of the same thing, like in social media, people talk about the wisdom of the crowd, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a similar concept, really. What you're looking for here is being able to tap the wisdom of the crowd for a specific project. And there's really no way to do that with closed architectures.
Yeah, absolutely. And OpenROV already has more than 1,000 people across 50 countries. We're growing really quickly. And these ROVs are already being built just based on the plans in a lot of different places. So very rapidly, a lot of people are kind of becoming experts and people who can really contribute valid mm-hmm. data.
Mm-hmm. What about educational uses? I mean, are you guys, if you've had a lot of interest from educational communities around this as well?
Oh, yeah, certainly. Yeah, there's so much cool stuff that this can do for education, and a lot of people have approached us, but also we've been kind of brainstorming ways that we think it can help out the most. Number one, I mean, I think about when I was a kid and what stuff would really excite me. You know, people can tell you about a coral reef, but if you can log on to an ROV over the internet and drive it around and you can see that little hermit crab and all that, I think that has a lot of just kind of understanding ability, you know, the ability to give people understanding about what a place is really like. And then building the ROV, I mean, the whole thing can be built in about a weekend or maybe a week. And so I think people putting these things together and asking questions, why does this fit, you know, in a certain way? So learning about how to build things and how to engineer things, learning by doing. There's a lot of potential there. And I think it's going to get really exciting once people can collaborate over the internet. You know, someone could have a place to deploy an ROV in one spot, and someone could contribute to the design in another. That seems cool.
And maybe even eventually control it from yet another spot, right?
Yeah, that would be really cool. And I mean, I'm a mechanical guy. Brand has been doing all the software for OpenROV, and I think that doing that's really ambitious. But
gotten this far.
Yeah.
Well, that's a big part of it. I mean, let's not wait anymore. I know people are really interested to see it. So you've actually brought a unit with you that this is like a prototype or a.
Sure.
Like I said, this is something that you guys actually had like in a big tub at Maker Faire, and you actually had controllers and people were controlling them and making them go up and down and swim all around and stuff.
Yeah,
and people were really really loving it. So explain what we're looking at.
Yeah,
here.
So let me show you kind of the basics of how it is. So let's see. In this front little bit is a camera. And you can kind of see the circular lens for that. That's just the USB web camera. And these two white things on either side are lights. They're 87 lumen LED lights that are really bright. And the whole thing is on this tilt platform. So inside of this clear tube, it can move up and down. So you can look down toward the payload module, which I'll describe later. Or you can look up, like at a ship's hull. It's on a servo.
So independent of the actual positioning of the... the outer shell.
And the ROV, just based on how it's designed, stays stable. It kind of stays in the horizontal position without tilting. Being able to look down and up is really valuable, especially if you're ascending or descending.
Right.
And then in the back, you can kind of see the corner of this. This is that BeagleBone computer.
Uh-huh.
It's a little computer that runs Linux, and it can host a web server. And then in the back, this is kind of a prototype one. So we've got a lot of kind of junk wires that are just hanging loose. This is what attaches to the tether. And you can kind of see them. They're black. They're these thrusters. And these spin and move the ROV forward and backward or left and right and let it turn. And on the top, there's another fan, another propeller, and that allows the ROV to move up and down. It's neutrally buoyant, so where you put it in the water, it just kind of stays at that level. Mm. And then you can thrust up and down. All the electronics and stuff are in this single tube. And actually, I can even take that off here. So this tube... is basically everything you need. Let's see, position it so the camera can see it. There's a little tether that goes in that goes to the motors and stuff like that. And then lastly, on the bottom, it's kind of easier to see with the tube off, are these battery packs. And so these hold C batteries,
four
in each. There's a total of eight. And that'll run the ROV for about an hour to an hour and a half.
Wow.
Yeah.
So everything operates off of C batteries?
Yeah, we wanted something that you can get anywhere. I mean, you could go into any 7-Eleven or random place, no matter where you are in the world, and replace the batteries.
That's fantastic.
A lot of times you don't have a charging station to recharge.
Right.
A lot of people on the forums, though, have been interested in like putting lithium batteries in greater capacity that would be rechargeable.
Right.
And in fact, there are ways of powering the ROV through the tether. It is a tethered vehicle. But right now we just have it so you run off of battery power on board.
That is what I was wondering. Since you got this cable going down to it already, why aren't you running power over Ethernet for it?
But we're actually not hearing you.
I think we're having some technical difficulties. Can't quite hear you.
Go ahead.
All right.
Can you say that again, Randall?
Yeah. I was just wondering that very thing. Why aren't you running power over Ethernet? It was just you have the tether there anyway.
Oh, yeah. So this is actually something we're talking about a lot right now, is the best way to do the tether. The thing is that it's super crucial to have a very thin tether. A lot of other ROVs you'll see out there, in fact, all the other ROVs that are kind of ones that you could buy, have these thick, neutrally buoyant tethers that are very expensive. They're, you know, dollars per foot sometimes.
Hmm.
And so the issue with that is, one, tethers are often damaged when you're going around rocks and stuff. They fatigue. They can break. And the other is by being that thick, to add the neutral buoyancy, they end up being very draggy in the water. Mm-hmm. And it reduces the performance of the ROV. So instead, what we're doing is we're using the thinnest tether possible. These two twisted wires, actually, I think I have a sample of it here. Let's see here. It's a sort of Ethernet cable, but it just has two twisted wires in it. And we've come up with a way of talking through that, but it's not very thick, so it can't handle very much power.
Okay.
If we wanted to send enough power for the ROV to run, through the tether, we could increase the voltage. We actually found these data over power line adapters that allow you to talk Ethernet over a AC line, but we didn't really want hobbyists putting, 120 volts AC into water.
Right.
Not a good plan.
But anyway, if people want to use Ethernet, there's an option for that as well. They just have to realize that their tether is going to be heavier in the water.
Right.
And so on.
Yeah, because you're going to have two more wires Actually, more than that for power over Ethernet.
Yeah, exactly.
You have three pair.
That's right. A standard Ethernet has four pairs. Mm-hmm. You only use two of the four pairs for the Ethernet, and there actually are ways of doing power over Ethernet using that, but it gets complicated really quickly. Mm-hmm. We'd like the tether to be this really simple, easy to replace, low cost, low mass thing, and that's kind of the approach we had there.
So was this thing always envisioned as being manually controlled, or are you somehow going to look at autonomous operation eventually?
That's something I think Brand can chime in on as well, but basically with an onboard computer, you can do either way. And I don't know, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, having a computer, especially you know, as computers become cheaper and more powerful, you start to have, you know, benefits of being able to do things like tracking, as I mentioned earlier, or you know, just so you can have it navigate itself, right? So to be autonomous. But actually, to answer the question, also, I know Eric is very passionate about telerobotics, so. It was, you know, kind of envisioned to be controlled. We wanted to allow the possibility to have it be autonomous, but it's also, you know, you should.
I think it's cool to have a joystick and drive it around. I mean, picture people who play, you know, video games. The most popular one is probably like World of Warcraft or something like that. I mean, autonomy is kind of neat if you get to program something and see what happens. I get that, and I think there's a lot of potential there. But, I mean, picture if you were like, okay, you know, there's this cool, magical World of Warcraft world, and you can write a character, and the character will go around and tell you what it finds. It's a lot more fun to drive it and actually say, I want to go look at what that is. What's that over there? I want to interact with it. But, you know, the kind of stuff that the brand has put into the software, we're utilizing OpenCV right now, which is a computer vision thing. You know, if you look at your Facebook account, you may notice that a lot of times it can recognize people's faces and say, mm-hmm. oh, you want to tag this person. Mm-hmm. I think now it even recognizes who the person might be. Mm-hmm. That's a form of computer vision. It's looking at an image and recognizing objects. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we were thinking, if you can do that, gosh, why can't you say, look for a seashell that looks a certain way? Mm-hmm. And maybe this is an invasive species and you want to detect all of them. So you could program the robot and say, I want you to find all seashells that are this color and this size and this pattern and tell me where they are or pick them up or something. Or there's object tracking, like a computer vision program. I might be able to click on my finger on my computer screen and it'll place a little virtual green dot on the tip of my finger. And as I move my finger, that stays on the tip. So if you can do that, why not say, follow that lobster or something like that? There's huge potential, I think. Mm-hmm. And this is still kind of an emerging technology. The processor that we have on our BeagleBone is barely capable of doing this. But, I mean, anticipate in the next year or so, the capabilities will just be amazing.
Right.
And so we definitely want to have this container that doesn't have a custom board but has something that anyone can put whatever device in so that we can kind of follow that technology curve.
Mm-hmm. Now, at the moment, it's strictly vision, right? So it's strictly just a camera in a shell. Shell, literally. Are you envisioning eventually having some sort of manipulation arms, gripper arms or something?
Yeah. Oh, right. This is cool. This is really cool. So, again, being able to add things that seem like they would be useful down the line or things that other people are just realizing would be really cool even if I don't realize it is super important. And that's why we put this payload bay on. You see these two threaded rods. If you look on the side, you'll see there's actually more holes. There's 1, 2, 3, 4 holes that are spaced 50 millimeters apart. They hold M5 rod. And that's a payload bay. And the camera can look down on it. And the idea is if someone wants to build a robot arm, they could just do that, put it on the payload bay. And anyone else, you know, because it's open source, hopefully their robot arm will also be open source. They could build the same thing and put it on the payload bay. I definitely think, like, in Sunnyvale, kind of near where I live, there's Intuitive Surgical, and they have these 6-degree of freedom robot arms. You could tie a shoelace with them. So,
wow.
Yeah, as people start developing those and metal detectors and, you know, bathymetry, you know, observation sets, or, you know, who knows what they'll come up with, they can put them on. And so that's definitely the idea. We also don't have it yet, but we plan to have compass and depth sensing pretty soon. One thing that I think about, you know, the new iPhone just came out, right? The iPhone 5. And everyone was talking about the rumors about what it might have. There are all these things people were getting really excited about, and some of them were, you know, things that were actually true, and that was awesome. And there were a lot of disappointments. People were expecting one feature or another that didn't come out. That's because Apple's closed. They keep their ideas secret, and then they release them, and they say, this is what you get. We're open source, so we can say, this is what we're offering. You know, this is what we've come up with. But any rumor that comes out of, what if OpenROV had this feature, someone else will do it. Someone in the community is going to create that. So picture any feature that you might want, and the ones that are most popular will prevail by their just by the nature of how open source and open hardware works.
What about turning this into a, as more of those options become available, mm-hmm. what about turning it into, it's already in a kit, but like, you know, modules, like, oh, you want to have gripper arms. Okay, well then, you know, like, can people order this online and just order the parts and put it together with various options, or is that... Or do they just look at the plan and then find their favorite electronic store and buy the parts there?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. Certainly for kind of custom niche things, I expect that people will build their own. Or maybe someone will build one and then put plans up of how they did it. Mm-hmm. You can go to Radio Shack and buy these parts and put them together in a certain way. But if an item becomes really popular, you know, OpenROV is also a business. We're a company. Mm-hmm. We're kind of a lifestyle company. We're doing this in order to be able to have fun. We're not trying to make a lot of money. But, you know, I could certainly foresee that we could start selling kits for add-ons and things like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, they may not even be our products. They may be something that someone else comes up with and there's enough demand that they can manufacture them and go through us. We haven't really figured that out
sure.
yet.
I'm thinking like the Maker Shed, you know, how they...
Yeah.
I mean, they don't really make a lot of the... I don't think they make any of the products, but they kind of like, oh, we'll throw in five LEDs and we'll throw in this and we'll throw in this and we'll ship it to you in a box and, you know, save you the hassle of trying to figure out
yeah.
how to do it. So I'm thinking more like that. How much does it cost?
Oh, yeah.
We haven't talked about that.
Right. So We launched this on Kickstarter recently. The idea is we wanted to just get a few of these out there, get it so we can start getting feedback from developers. And we're really targeting just hobbyists and people who, you know, if there are little bugs and flaws, that's okay. They'll you know, take it and run with it and make it better. So we were hoping to raise $20,000 on Kickstarter from selling these kits for $775, I think, around $750 plus shipping.
Hmm.
It did pretty well. We ended up selling out, or not selling out. We ended up reaching our Kickstarter goal in 2.5 hours.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
That was really exciting. I remember that morning you were there and David, who's my co-founder, he's the other guy from OpenROV. And so the three of us were at my house and we clicked go and immediately it just started going up and up and up. So we reached our goal in 2.5 hours and then it just kept on going.
Mm-hmm.
We ended up selling about 100 OpenROV kits, which is just phenomenal. And then we've also been issuing serial numbers. They all have these serial numbers on the back of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so if someone's building one on their own, they can email us and say, I want a serial number. And based on that, we think that already there's probably about 200 around the world.
Wow.
Or 200 serial numbers that have gone out. About under $1,000 is our goal. We always want it to be... you know, the cost of like a nice camera and maybe even cheaper later if we can figure out a way to do that.
And relative to the what other people are doing, I mean, what is that? Like, you know, I know you were saying you're actually going to be driving something down in Antarctica.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So, I mean, you know about these things. Like how much do they cost to build one,
right.
you know, on a scientific project or something? Like, what would they use? What's the comparison?
Yeah, so there are other similar ROVs. These are called observation class ROVs. You know, in other words, they call it observation class because it just has a camera. It's not really meant for lifting heavy things or doing big maneuvers, but kind of just looking at stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But most of those are on the order of about $10,000 on the cheap end. I think a typical observation class ROV might be several tens of thousands of dollars, which is... you know, okay if you're an industry, you know, if you're a utility that wants to inspect a dam or something like that, but it's not affordable by the everyday person. Kind of the tagline I've been using is that it shouldn't take a research grant to do exploration. It should take curiosity. So there are no other ROVs that are as low cost as OpenROV. So that's really important. We want it to be low cost and accessible, you know, an order of magnitude lesser in cost. But we also want it to be something that you can build really easily. This is something, you know, a father and son could build in their garage and use in their pool, but it's still also something capable of doing legitimate scientific mm-hmm. research. We
right.
want this to be able to really do the stuff that the other ROVs can too. So it's designed to go to 100-meter depth. So far we've tested it to 20, and it seems to be working pretty well.
Oh, that's great. Now, hopefully by now we've piqued everybody's interest, right? And is there a place where people can go to...
to see video? I mean, can there are YouTube sites? I think on your website there might have been some sort of documentary or something. But can people see the video that actually gets captured from these units?
Yeah, sure. So openrov.com is our website, and we're constantly posting new things. But yeah, I think right now actually on our main webpage is still our old Kickstarter video. Mm-hmm. And in part of that, you can see footage from when we drove it around the Aquarius module, which is this underwater sea lab in Florida. And NASA does this mission called the NEMO mission, where they actually have aquanauts, I guess, down there for 10 days at a time doing a kind of, you know, simulation of what it would be like to be in space. And so we got to go to Florida and drive the ROV around and drive it around the module. If you look on YouTube through, you know, Google Open ROV, you can find a lot of these videos.
Okay, good.
Yeah, so that's really cool. There's some great footage. Actually, we had a GoPro camera attached to the top of the ROV, and so most of the footage is from that.
Oh, okay. So is that different than, is the camera that's in the ROV not able to
Time that we went to Florida, we weren't streaming live video.
Ah,
up.
Okay.
That was kind of early on, and we're still developing things. Yeah, the new camera that we have, this webcam, is also wide angle. But of course, you know, a GoPro or a really fancy camera like that is going to record extremely good video.
Right. And it's also going to raise the price.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, let's talk about the software because, you know, we haven't been able to get you into the conversation here.
I talk a lot,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's get Brand in on the conversation. Let's talk about the software a little bit. So what are some of the challenges in designing the software for this? Was it similar to what I would do with like an Arduino?
So there actually is some Arduino programming involved. It depends on your skill level, really. You know, Node.js is still kind of a fairly new thing. Mm-hmm. That's kind of the bulk of what the software is written in. So that's JavaScript. So it's not too terrible of a language to learn. Everything else is basically C++. So there is an Arduino on board that we program to actually do the, you know, control the thrusters and the hardware aspects of it. And then there's also another small process. That's the camera capture process, where it actually takes the photo and then sends it to the node process. Sorry, I'm trying not to get too technical, but anyway, that's
this is a technical audience,
well.
So it's okay.
Oh, okay, cool.
Indulge. Yes.
This is the one show where it's like, yeah, whatever, man. Technical stuff is great. So
yeah, go ahead, right. Geek out, guys.
That's right.
All right,
okay, cool.
It's really cool. So. Yeah.
And then there's this other thing called WebSockets. It's kind of new. So that's what actually handles the connection between the client side and the server side. So that's how we're able to pass commands from the browser down to the ROV, and how we're able to send video back up to the client from the ROV.
Hmm.
So what does the user interface actually look like? Are you hitting buttons on a web page or something?
So it's all still in development as well. We actually started with the user interface, and we're not quite up to that yet. Basically, we're still, you know, prototyping and just getting the software to work in the first place. So it's basically just a little image tag, and you can just see the video. We have keyboard control, so, you know, up, down, arrows on your keyboard. We're also trying to implement using like a PlayStation 3 controller, an Xbox controller, using Gamepad API, which is new to Firefox, you know, really, really new modern browsers. Mm-hmm. I think like some of the, you know, like not even released yet ones. So Gamepad API is what we're using for that. So the interface is, still needs a lot of work. And actually, we have a bunch of people, several people, working all over the world on the interface right now. So if you go to our website, openrov.com, you can kind of contribute to some of that development and help out.
Cool.
All this source code and stuff is on GitHub, so you can download it and try it out.
Right. So I just want to clarify something that you were just saying. It's just starting to register in my head, is that this is really all going through a web interface?
Yeah.
So that's why you need this Gamepad API. It's all going through a browser. It's not
right.
So why? Why did you do it that way?
The main reason is because we wanted to make these ROVs be able to be used online. So it's kind of an easy transition if it's already kind of, you know, online in a way, right?
Right.
But also, you know, I mentioned this before, the aspect of not having to have software on your computer, right?
Right?
You can just grab any laptop that has, you know, Ethernet right now, and then just start using it. If your laptop breaks or gets wet or whatever, you know, grab another laptop, log in, and you're good to go. Hmm. You don't have to install drivers or anything. You can just start controlling the ROV.
Right. Awesome. Forward thinking. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Because I know if I started to do something like that, I would be like, okay, serial connection, right? Like, this is how I'm going to do it. So I love the forward thinking there.
There was something else I was going to ask you. So can we talk just quickly? You mentioned some of them, but like, what are the common ways that people are using this right now? Are they, is it to map streams or like what? What are the ways that you've heard that people are using this right now?
The most exciting ones are the ones we haven't even heard of yet. There's so many different ones. There's good footage right now of us driving around at this lake. This is just to look around. This is this tiny little reservoir kind of behind our house, behind my house. And that first time we drove it with live video, there was like this little stick coming out. And we're like, oh, let's just look at the stick so we can track it. And we went down, and within moments, like, there were fish. Like, oh my God, what? You were looking at these different species. So I think something like that is going to be really popular. A lot of people want to buy this because there's a little pond next to their house, or there's, they dropped their keys when they were out fishing recently and they want to go look at them. We hear a lot from people who own boats who want to inspect the zincs on their boats and things like that, or who go to interesting places and they don't really want to suit up and go snorkeling or scuba diving, but they want to just check out what's down there. Mm-hmm. There's a surprisingly large amount of ocean professionals who are on OpenROV. We see tons of professional ROV pilots, oceanographers, people from industry who have some sort of a purpose. We've seen guys who want to inspect water towers and places like that. Quite a bit of scientists are interested in using these. I've talked to some people at NASA who have projects that they want to incorporate OpenROV with. There's this huge, wide range. A lot of people also who are hearing about interesting phenomena that they want to check out. I remember at Maker Faire, there was that guy who saw these huge schools of, like, I don't know what kind of fish it was, but like he said that they were swimming in an almost cube-shaped formation and wanted to check out why. So, I mean, who knows? That's the exciting part.
So what about, maybe this is just my mind going crazy, but what about like utilities? Like, I've had people come out to like clean like, drains and things right at my house. And they send this camera down and they shove it down in the drain and they're like, oh, you got lots of roots down here. It's going to be $1,000, So what about things like that though for underwater? I'm thinking for utilities and things, checking out pipes and water supplies and things like that. I mean,
that's absolutely useful. I mean, if you can think of it, it probably can do that. Certainly, OpenROV is a really small ROV. It doesn't have a huge amount of power. A lot of people have said, "Oh, you ought to get into the oil industry. There's tons of money there." But I guess there's some interest there. Because how big that market is. But I mean, OpenROV isn't going to be able to handle huge amounts of current and big swells of the ocean. A lot of times, larger ROVs are better for that. Certainly utilities. And then here's another one that just kind of excites me. I've piloted larger ROVs for a lab that I worked for and some other stuff. And I remember once we, for instance, did a deployment in Lake Tahoe. And we went down to about, in feet, I guess it would be like 120 feet or something like that. And we did several deployments. And every time we got down to the bottom, within minutes, we'd start seeing man-made objects, kind of like how you see junk on the side of the freeway that's lightweight and blows in the wind and no one wants to pick up. Mm-hmm. Well, the water is, people are dropping things that they can't pick up, and they're generally heavy, which means that they have more value than, like, a plastic bag. We were seeing pocket knives and sunglasses and anchor chains, and someone said they even found poker chips once. So I think you could make a killing if you just had these and went to popular places where people boat and just drove it around with a little hook. You could add a little chemical gas thing that would inflate a balloon, lift things to the surface, or attach a lead line.
Metal detector on there.
Yeah, put a metal detector on there. There's so much stuff down there, and there's no brush for it to get hidden in. The sediment layer usually accumulates slowly. So things can get dropped and just wait there for 20 years, and no one's picked them up. So that's really exciting to me, too. I think that when people start showing YouTube videos of driving around and picking things up, that people will get really excited.
Yeah. Will this ever be wireless? Guessing the water is a barrier there, literally.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, is that happening now? Or is there any work on different types of communication mechanisms to
make
these wireless?
If you go on OpenROV, I've made kind of this decision tree of our thinking about how to do tethers, including wireless. It's really hard to get video through water because water attenuates RF, especially at high frequencies, which you need for high bandwidth. if you were to use a really, really low frequency, you could probably command the ROV, but you couldn't get video back. Mm. People have also talked about acoustic modems or light and stuff. And, I mean, we kind of have to keep focused on one thing and do that well. But certainly with this large community we have out there, and a lot of people who are brilliant, I mean, people who are PhDs in, you know, underwater communications, mm-hmm. I think we'll end up contributing things ultimately down the line. Mm-hmm. Another great advantage of open hardware.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons I think you said the tether had to be lightweight is because obviously the ROV is pulling it along and it doesn't have that mm-hmm. much thrust. I was wondering, have you looked at unreeling the tether behind you as you go forward, like having a little reel on that?
Yeah, the first real mission that I actually, this is, the design of the ROV was largely influenced by this first mission I wanted to do, which was to explore this underwater cave in Northern California that no one had ever completely explored. And actually there's rumors that in the 1800s there was a gold robbery. And these thieves threw the gold down this water-filled pit, not knowing how deep it was, and no one's ever been able to recover it. So, story true or not, we don't care. That was a good kind of impetus to go there. And so I was thinking that if we have this very, very thin, single, twisted pair wire, that we could actually spool it out from the ROV, like a spider spinning a web. And certainly, yeah, that's a great idea. It's yet to be developed, you know, a good way to unspool it so it doesn't get tangled, maybe like the way that Ethernet that comes in boxes is spooled up. But yeah, then you don't have the accumulating drag effect and so on.
So how long can the tether go now, since you do have to drag it behind your craft?
We've been having a lot of trouble with it. We'd like it to be able to do 100 meters. And right now we have these little, they're hybrids. They're these things that adapt Ethernet to a single twisted pair. And those limit communication to about 60 meters. Mm-hmm. Everything on OpenROV, by the way, is in metric. We just like the metric system better. I think we should push that, at least open source, open hardware movement, maybe start using that standard.
Everybody else.
Yeah. It's a good way to go, right? It's the right way. So right. We'll start
for,
from open hardware.
Well, international projects, I mean, that's reason enough alone to actually...
Yeah, actually, some of our greatest contributors are in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
So anyway, yeah, about 60 meters or, you know, around 200 feet is probably about the length that we can go now. I think that'll improve, and we'll get to that 100 meters very quickly, especially when other people start contributing.
Somebody in the chat room suggesting fiber optic tether?
Yes.
I was just going to ask that.
That's a great idea. We've looked at fiber optic. It's great because it's neutrally buoyant, and mm-hmm. it's really high bandwidth, and it can be made very thin. The problems with it, though, are that, one, converting the fiber optic back to something that you can understand with a microcontroller like Ethernet or USB is non-trivial. Mm-hmm. Right. They do sell devices, but they're large or they're expensive. And then the other thing is fiber optic is very fragile, and mm-hmm. it's harder to get. As a general philosophy, we've been trying to use electronics on board the ROV to make it so you can use the cheapest tether possible. Mm-hmm. We don't want to have a custom one. So we're not really pursuing it that much, but that doesn't mean that no one else can. Someone else I see just commented, no power. That's another great point. Mm-hmm. Right now, we're not sending power down the existing tether we have, but later on we could. If it was fiber optic, that wouldn't really be an option. So, and they're batteries anyway. All these are really great ideas. The other thing is, with a thin tether, even if we can't pump enough power down to sustain the ROV, you know, at full running, if you have rechargeable batteries, you can kind of trickle charge them. So as long as you get the average amount of power consumption down the line, then that works. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yeah, we can see the chat. So these are great. It's what's happening now is what we're hoping will happen in a larger scale on OpenROV. I mean, there are people out there that are really smart. I think people generally kind of, you know, they don't have much faith in what they call the general public. They say, oh, you know, the average person isn't going to be able to contribute. But there are really smart people out there. The people who are talking right now know their stuff, or they have ideas. Or maybe they have an idea that's crazy and would be shot down by a lot of, you know, mm-hmm. upstanding engineers. But if they go out and try it and do it, the proof is in the pudding.
Right.
I have huge faith in the community. Mm-hmm. So you guys who are commenting now, we need you. Join OpenROV.
Yeah.
Great.
Now, you guys, how are you guys making a living? I mean, do you have other jobs? Or, I mean, how is this possible?
No, I mean, I'm in debt right now. I my credit card's maxed out and I have no money in my account. I've put it all into OpenROV, but this is what, if I never had to worry about money, if I was a millionaire, this is what I'd be doing for fun anyway. Bran, heck, you're looking for a job. If anyone's hiring excellent programmers, we're both, you know, looking to find other ways of funding this so we can do it on our own. Ultimately, it'd be really cool if we made enough that we could do this as what we do. I mean, this is a cool life. We're going to these crazy places, exploring things with ROVs. That would be really awesome.
Well, that's always a good way for people to get involved who maybe aren't interested in running their own, right? They can make a donation, I'm assuming, somehow.
And
support the work, even if it's not, even if they don't want to actually make one and drive one themselves. Right?
Yeah.
Right.
And I mean, we did make some money from Kickstarter. Our margins are very small, and especially because we're just starting out, and, you know, already we've made some mistakes, and I'm sure we'll make more that will cost some of, more of that margin, right? Like, shipping will be more expensive than we expected. So we're expecting to get a little bit from Kickstarter that we can, you know, pay ourselves with a little bit, at least to, you know, get some top ramen. But then also, like, I have this other project I'm working on right now, which is called Skinny, S-C-I-N-I. It's this other ROV that we're going to deploy down in Antarctica. And so I've been doing that kind of as a part-time job as a consultant, and I can make a little bit of money that way. And so there are other little things here and there. OpenROV, I think, is a good way to introduce us to, you know, opportunities down the line.
Well, and that's kind of the other thing I was wondering is whether this would be something. You know, a lot of people do this duality approach where, for example, with this, you know, you have OpenROV, and then you have maybe something larger, more fancy. You know, you take all the learning that you get in OpenROV and make something that you can sell to the gas and oil companies, right? That, you know, that's where you make your your money, so to speak, but this is your passion, and this is what drives you and stuff like that. I mean, I wonder if that's maybe an approach that you could take down the road if this, you know, becomes something that that people are really interested in.
I think so. I mean, we really want to make sure that we're always getting directly what we want out of OpenROV. You know, that thing I mentioned earlier, I have a bunch of roommates who, a lot of them have been very successful in Silicon Valley and stuff. And I remember in the kitchen once asking around, I said, you know, if you never had to worry about money, you know, what would you do? What would you spend your time doing? And a majority of them said they'd be doing basically what they were doing now. And that really hit home for me. OpenROV is that way. When I said earlier that, you know, yes, we're a business, but, you know, it's a lifestyle business, what I meant is if I never had to worry about making money, what would I do for fun? This would be it. Mm-hmm. So there's less entropy there. And if we end up being too much of a big corporation, too much of a, you know, trying to get investors and all that, I think that we'll be kind of pushed aside from that core goal. And I think having these hobbyists, you know, and doing things at the hobby level, it really has a lot more fun potential.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about some of the one of the questions we haven't asked yet. I probably should let Randall ask these questions, but so as far as license goes for the code that's online, what are we talking about?
Well, actually, we originally had a Creative Commons license for everything, but it's not really appropriate for software, from what I understand. I'm still kind of new to all this stuff anyway, but so we're thinking about switching over to an MIT license.
Okay.
So that's
great.
Actually in the works right now.
That's about as free as you can get to. I mean, it's basically the same as Creative Commons, except it's meant for software. So.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, we just need to make those changes. You know?
And the hardware is all, is now Creative Commons attribution share alike. So that seems to work for now, although there really isn't any standard for real hardware. It doesn't really counteract what a patent would do. And that's needed. Hopefully in the near future, there'll be a kind of Creative Commons equivalent for hardware design.
Right.
I believe there are actually some open source hardware licenses out there that are being used. Did you look like the Arduino's license?
Yeah, they use Creative Commons.
Oh, okay.
You're right. There are some things that exist, but they're not exactly the right fit. There are also some licenses that we want to be careful of, because if you use something that is proprietary and it's involved with your non thing, then like the license spreads. And this is new to us. You know, we're trying to be very careful, and you know, we can't afford to have, you know, an on staff lawyer to help us out. But
right.
And also, this taking this a little bit further, I just want to test the limits of your open source philosophy here for just a second.
Good.
If somebody came along, because you're obviously trying to, you got a company around this, you're trying to sell these kits too as part of the way you're making money. If somebody came along and commercialized this and could make them cheaper and undercut you entirely, how would you feel
so
about
that? We're kind of on a corner right now. So right now we're licenses Creative Commons non-commercial attribution share alike 3.0. And the non-commercial means that, okay, if you're building this just on your own for a hobby, go ahead. But if you're going to start pushing these out and selling them, for profit, at least talk to us first. That's kind of what we're, and that's how MakerBot does it, and that's how I believe Arduino does it. We're not sure yet, but we have been considering taking away the non-commercial, saying, you know, people say, oh, what if someone steals your idea? It might be more valuable to for us to respond, steal away, take it. Because, you know, yes, someone could undercut us, but if they do, it's share alike. They have to say how they're doing it. Where are they getting cheaper parts? How are they manufacturing it for lower costs? That would be really valuable data for us. And ultimately, our big picture goal is still achieved. There are more open ROVs out there in the world, and people are coming up with more creative ways to make them cheaply and in greater masses. So I think the value of that actually would be really big. We just, you know, we want to be careful that we keep control, that we can make sure that the open ROV design is kind of managed so that we don't end up with a bunch of different variations, and when someone makes a contribution, it's not useful to the other half of people or something like that. That's really the only reason right now that we're doing non-commercial.
Cool, cool. So a little bit more about the software just for a second here. So Brian, could you go back in here again? What's actually running on the little piece of hardware? I forget the beanpole, bean something.
BeagleBone.
BeagleBone. Okay. What's actually is it a version of Linux? Is it embedded Linux or is it something else?
Yeah, it's Ubuntu Linux, and the choice for that was mainly because that was what I was most familiar with, but also because there's a lot of future in Ubuntu. There's a lot of development in it, and there's, you know, you can, any package you want to download, you basically just, you know, apt-get and then there you go. So that's definitely a benefit. But I also mentioned it's running Node.js as the web server, which is dependent on Google V8 and OpenCV, as Eric mentioned.
So I've got a question then based on this. What about, because we talked about Raspberry Pi too.
Yeah.
I mean, is there things to be learned? Because obviously Raspberry Pi has a few Debian-based, which Ubuntu is also Debian-based. Mm-hmm. So Raspberry Pi has a couple different Debian variations, slimmed down Debian variations that you can use. Wouldn't that be more better?
Wouldn't that be faster,
better to use?
Right.
Faster and, you know, a lot less stuff preloaded. You know, Ubuntu has a lot of stuff that they try to be a community or, you know, like a everyman's version of Linux, right? So they load a lot of stuff in there automatically. So wouldn't something stripped down be better?
Yeah. and I guess I should have mentioned this also. We're not dependent on Ubuntu. You can use any Linux you want, as long as you can install OpenCV and Node.js. You know, if you can figure out how to do that,
right,
then you can use any version of Linux. Elinux.org is the site that we use. And they have Fedora, they have Debian, they have Ubuntu, they have Angstrom, which is actually the one that comes with the BeagleBone. We moved away from that because we were having a little bit of trouble with development earlier on. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so that's not a strict dependency, right?
Oh, okay, good. Mm-hmm. Good to know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I want one of these already. Everything that's cool that comes on this show, I want one of already anyway. But this is cool. I'm actually afraid of the water. So part of this is like, I don't have to like learn to scuba. I could just send this thing down there and have it move things around and look at things. This would be really, really awesomely cool. Is there anything, we're almost out of time. I just want to let you know that. Is there anything that we haven't covered that you want to make sure our audience is aware of about this project?
We're really looking for people who have ideas, whether they're crazy ideas or not, to contribute. I mean, OpenROV is all about the community. So definitely a plug. Like, we really hope you log on to openrov.com, you know, join the forums, chime in. We want that community to be as active as possible. And if people want an ROV in the future, you know, Kickstarter's already closed, but we're hoping that in another few months we might be able to launch another thing where perhaps we make more of them available in a batch. We're still kind of figuring that out, but kind of stay posted, I guess, if you're interested. But there is a place where you can write your email address down if you're interested in getting a kit in the future, and when they become available again, we'll let you know.
Oh, so wait, you effectively pre-sold 200 of these already. What's the manufacturing process going to be like for that? Is that two guys in a shed somewhere?
Me and Bran and David are going to be at Tech Shop just pumping these things out. Wow. We've already got a bunch of them laser cut. We've just been going in and working on that. But, you know, we can't afford to hire a staff. We're not that big yet. So we're in there every day, you know, cutting pieces and counting nuts and bolts and putting them in boxes.
And a good part of it is, you know, 100 of those are actually kits. So we just have to kind of laser cut the parts and then just put them together. The users will actually be building them themselves. Right. So that takes a little bit of stress off us, especially since our deadline is supposed to be the end of this month. So.
Yeah, and I'm leaving Antarctica in October.
Yeah.
Does that plastic have an odor when it's cut? And are you now sick of that?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. No, when I start seeing things, you know, that it's time to take the fresh air.
Brandon, last words from you?
No, he covered everything. I think we got a lot done here. This is great.
Okay. Good. Then I have to ask my required two questions, which if you've seen the show before, you know what's coming up. Eric, you first. Favorite text editor?
Favorite text editor?
No.
Brand will MS Paint?
For text.
I do everything with MS Paint. It's the greatest thing ever. That's I'm going to stick with that.
Oh, and scripting language. Favorite scripting language?
If you do
scripting. Really,
I'm a mechanical engineer, man. Brand, can you recommend one to me?
Python. We go with Python. OpenRV goes with Python. That's a fun.
Yeah, there we go. Whatever Brand recommends, I trust him. He knows his stuff. All right, how about you?
And I use Vi for OpenRV development, just because we have to SSH into the ROV and
makes sense.
Just stab you from all different directions here. Okay. You guys are doing a great job, but you have bad, poor choice in tools.
I also use Sublime Text when I'm on my Mac. So.
Hey, actually, we had a question in from the chat room. I skipped past it. So we got one last question in here that's actually about the ARPU and ROV. Somebody asked about using MakerBot to print some of the parts. Mm-hmm. Are there parts in there that can be printed with this? And would that plastic be suitable for using this in OpenRV?
I love the idea of using a MakerBot because they're open source and open hardware. So this is kind of family thing. You know, OpenROV has a lot of these parts that are really kind of flat and they fit together. And so that's not really appropriate for what MakerBot does. The other thing is that I think a lot of times when you have these kind of accumulating plastic manufacturing methods, they may fall apart in the kind of environments we're going in. So I don't know. Payload modules I think would be a great fit for that. And if someone wants to screw around and see what happens, then that would be good too. Nothing yet from us, though, that way.
Yeah. Very good. Well, I think that's the last question. At least if we have any more, we'll bring it back on another show. And next time you got to bring an aquarium so you can see it actually.
We're going to be at the World Maker Fair in New York later this month. So if anyone's in the New York area, they should check us out.
Oh, good.
Great. So Eric Stackpole and Brian Surm, well, thanks for coming on the show. And thanks for telling about your story.
Yeah, thank you.
Very good. So Aaron, what'd you think?
Well, you know, I'm going to be excited about this, right? Because this is what I live for. This is what I do in my spare time at home. So, I think this is great. You know, just being the fact that it's open, the fact that people can contribute, the fact that it's all crowdsourced, all the ideas to do different things with it. I mean, I think that this is a perfect experiment to see if, you know, Arduino is kind of the poster child for open hardware right now, and I think that that's shown a high degree of success for doing something like this. So I think this is just going to take off. Now, maybe it's not as maybe it doesn't have the mass appeal that Arduino does, because this is really for people that want to explore in the water, right? So that's a limited subset there. But you know, I think that there's enough people out there. I think this will really take off, and I hope that everybody goes out and checks out the website and you know, if they're really interested, you know, order a kit or go make your own kit. Make one. It's out there. You can do it, and I think people should try. There's a lot of good learning there as well. Just in the trying, just in the putting it together, you have to learn about a lot of new things. So it's also a good learning experience for someone that wants to get into open hardware beyond Arduino. You know, if they want to get into, oh, well, how do I hook up motors? How do I make it waterproof? How do I do some of those other things? I think this is a good project to learn from. In fact, it would be interesting to actually take this and adapt it for classroom experience. So not building the whole thing, but like maybe I take a plastic bottle and I hook up a couple of things to it and I can make it swim around my bathtub or something. I think it would be a really cool experiment for little kids, like I said, either in the classroom or at home, maybe a summer camp to build something like this. I think it would be great. And obviously it's appealing. I can tell you based on the number of kids that were playing with it at Maker Faire, Bay Area Maker Faire, I mean, it's obviously appealing to kids. It's a lot of fun. So it could be a great educational tool.
Well, there's something about driving something, I think. Mm-hmm. I remember the first time I was in a motorized vehicle, I was on a motorbike. it was amazing that I didn't have to pedal to make it go forward. I just turned the handle and it moved forward. And ever since then, it's like, you know, remote control thingies, little remote control cars and little planes and stuff like that. That's all a lot of fun. And it's nice that this is also not just about fun, although that's obviously a strong element of that, but that there actually are practical applications. We can use it to go and look at ocean floors and sea floors and inspect things with it and stuff. So it's not just, you know, not just something to be fun, but it's actually got some practical value. So I do want one, but I don't know where I'd keep it these days. I'm not around water that often. Oh, on my cruises, I could have it floating along.
Oh, there you go.
The cruises, yeah. It's slipping along the bottom of the ship as,
you know,
as we're going along.
You should suggest that. That could be a feature, right? Like, you know, you could have like a feed from the ROV up to like, you know, web browsers. So people can just log on to a web page and see like, oh, what's going on this, you know, while we're docked in this port, what's going on under the whatever, you know, that might be kind
somehow
of cool.
I think they'd be a bit discouraged. What are you doing sitting ROVs down around our port? They're all controlled, you know, they're all security and stuff. They'll be freaking out about all that stuff. Well, it's just great. It was a lot of fun. I was really glad that these guys could also come into the Brick House and actually be with us in person. Really odd that I'm the only one Skyping in today. So that was really crazy. Speaking of upcoming shows, that was my awkward transition for the day. We haven't got too many more new people on the list yet. I'm still sending out mail, waiting for people to respond and pick dates and stuff like that. But we do have a few shows already still scheduled. We have Jaspersoft, which is a business intelligence software. They're coming in, I think, next week or the week after. Must be next week, because I think they're all booked solid for a while. KVM, the virtualization software that's being used, developed by Red Hat's actually sort of managing that. But it's basically the power behind the cloud, making it so we could have virtual machines everywhere. HPCC Systems, which is high-performance computing, so we get teraflops and all sorts of things out of that. The ER chatbot, which is a Jabber-based chatbot that has intelligent responses to being sent commands and stuff like that. Just added to the list, we have Poodle, which is probably the cutest name we have of any project we've had on for a while. Poodle is an online translation management tool, translation interface. So if you have to internationalize your software, apparently this makes it a lot easier to work with people all over the world to do their part of the stuff on that. So that's going to be pretty interesting as well. It's all open source software, of course. Lots of email flying around again, trying to book all the rest of Q4. You can follow the progress I make on that by going to twit.tv/floss. There is a spreadsheet linked from there that talks about all the upcoming guests and the exact dates that we're going to be on the show. Next week again, we will be back on Wednesday again. Unless Apple has another announcement next Wednesday, but so far, I think they've already announced it. They did it yesterday, so we're on Thursday today. If you weren't aware of that. Wednesdays at 8:30 Pacific time. That's when we tape. We do have a live chat room. We got a number of questions from the chat room today, so that was a lot of fun having people ask us questions that we can ask the guests of. You can follow us on Floss Weekly on Google+, on at Floss Weekly on Twitter and Identica. You can also follow me and all the places I'm doing and being things at Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N. I'm also much more prolific on Google+. I've got about 4 or 5 postings a day there, sometimes pretty interesting things. I'll be in New Orleans. My next trip out is a New Orleans planning retreat from September 28th to October 5th. So if you're in the New Orleans area, watch for my tweets or just tweet me at Merlyn and I'll notice it right away. And we could hook up there as well. Aaron, that's all my plugins. What do you have to plug today?
So basically, if you want to follow me, you should follow me on Google+. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter, pretty much at Aaron Newcomb on all of those things. But the best place to have a conversation with me, actually interact, is on Google+, where I talked about my new favorite thing since yesterday, this little mini keyboard, which I got on Amazon for $23. If you go on Google+, there's a link where you can actually order one. A couple of people have already ordered one. I would definitely follow me on Google+, where I talk about this kind of stuff that I'm doing with the Raspberry Pi or any other projects that I happen to be working on at the moment. That is definitely the best place to interact with me. Also, since I'm not sure I'll be on before that, if you are heading to Oracle Open World, I do work for Oracle. I'll be at Oracle Open World. I'll actually be giving a session and in the demo ground. So if you happen to be at Oracle Open World, and there's a lot of people that cross over between enterprise and open source and all this stuff, please look me up. Come find me and talk to me if you're a fan of the show or if you just want to say hi or whatever. Please don't hesitate to look me up or find me and come to my session, hang out afterwards. I'd love to have a drink with anybody if they're in town. I know a lot of people, it's like 40,000, 50,000 people in town for Open World. So there's a good chance that somebody listening to the show is going to be there. So definitely come say hi.
Very good. And Aaron, thanks again for getting up as early as you had to come into the Brick House as early as it is.
Yeah, it is very early, but it's worth it. It's worth every moment of lost sleep.
All right, very good, very good. And I hear the music coming up in the background, so we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.